Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. For nearly 40 years, Jim Simone patrolled Cleveland's 2nd District, a drug-plagued area with one of the highest violent crime rates in the U.S. Nicknamed Super Cop, Simone generated headlines and public interest on a scale not seen since Elliot Ness' search for Cleveland's torso murderer in the 1930s. Simone entered police work after serving in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne, where he earned 2 Bronze Stars and 2 Purple Hearts. As a cop, he never shied from danger. He was involved in numerous gun battles and killed 5 people in the line of duty, all ruled justifiable. Notoriously equitable as a cop, Simone was more interested in doing the right thing than honoring the Blue Code. Badge 387 recounts the brave exploits that earned Simone hundreds of commendations. In 1983, while searching a church basement for a gunman, he was shot in the face. Despite his wounds, he managed to shoot his assailant, saving himself and 2 other cops. And in 2009, he plunged into a frigid river to save a woman. Simone was Cleveland's Patrolman of the Year in 1980 and 2009, the only officer in the city's history to receive the award twice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Badge 387, the story of Jim Simone, America's most decorated cop, with my special guest journalist and author, Robert Spurna. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Robert Spurna.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you very much for joining me on this program this evening with this incredible book. The question I want to ask is how did you make the decision to write this book at this time? With everything going on in America right now, true crime author with all kinds of options, I would think, for you to be able to write a book, was this book important? Why was a book about Jim Simone and his police work an important book to write now?
I took kind of a circuitous route to this book. I originally, in May 2013, Ariel Castro, the so-called Cleveland kidnapper who had held 3 women hostage in his house for 10 years, he was in the news. One of the women had broken loose, and the world saw the rescue of these three hostages. I wanted to do something on that book. That was a Cleveland story. I'm a Clevelander, but international media descended on that, and I didn't find I could get a real good piece of that book. In investigating that case, I discovered that Ariel Castro, who was a Cleveland school bus driver, Jim Simone had done a traffic stop on him a couple years before the women had escaped, like 2011 or so. And he had a dash cam of the traffic stop. And because Castro was a school bus driver and Simone knew that if he arrested him, because he was riding a motorcycle with improper plates, arrested him, he'd lose his job. So Simone gave him a warning, let him go. So national news shows were interviewing Simone about that traffic stop because there was a big hunger for any news about the case, of course. And it even got as far as some broadcasters accusing Simone of letting the Cleveland kidnapper slip through his fingers, as if Jim would have known he had 3 women in his basement, right? So I didn't get that book deal. But in talking to Simone over the next year or so, and we had the Ferguson case with Michael Brown, we had Eric Garner in New York, we had 2 people in Cleveland that were killed by police. I just started getting interested in what happens in a police-involved shooting. In other words, Dan, what happens in that split second where some police shoot and some police don't. I realized that I had a real gem in Simone, not to be lighthearted about this, of course, because Jim had been involved in 5 fatal shootings, all ruled justifiable. So I pivoted towards him and I just proposed the book to him and we got it done. My goal in doing the book, of course, was to surface some issues about police-involved shootings.
Now, you talk about, you said there's a couple weighty questions. You said, what are the inciting factors to compel a police officer to take lethal action? And you say, and this I think is important for all of us, is that can civilians fairly judge a cop's split-second response to perceived deadly situation? And is the media acting objectively in its second-guessing of police discretion, or is there an agenda?
No, I don't think at that split second we can really put ourselves in that police officer's shoes. It's a matter of them believing that they're in fear for their lives, and how can we judge that? We can, however, look at the context. Some officers, most shootings, a small percentage of police officers are involved in a large percent of shootings. In the 70s, people coming out of Vietnam, such as Jim Simone, they were given preferential hiring by police departments. They wanted that type of proactive, aggressive personality, regimented like Jim was. That's a no-nonsense, balls-to-the-wall officer. That's the guy that would chase danger and not shy from danger and maybe face it head-on. Okay, so if we look at it from that standpoint in 2016, now maybe we can judge that. We can say, well, why did you run into that basement? The gunman wasn't going anywhere. He was trapped. Why not wait for SWAT? Why not wait for a supervisor to get there? So we can judge the actions beforehand, I think. But once an officer is face-to-face with somebody and they feel danger, it'd be very hard to second-guess them. As to the question about the media, what I found out was, and I used to be a reporter for newspapers, I think the media nowadays, they're forced into a position where they have to cover events, not news. Police shoots unarmed man. That's the headline. Well, that's true. Maybe, but we don't have the whole story. It's going to take a couple days, maybe a week, to find out really what the story was. What was he holding in his hand? Why did the police officer feel like he was going to kill him? We don't get that background anymore up front. Before electronic media, before blogs, and citizen journalists, reporters had kind of an unspoken rule with police. You know, give us a couple hours. Give us a tomorrow morning, let us figure this out, and, we'll give you a story. Well, it doesn't happen that way anymore. There's so much competition to get clicks, coverage, that they're just covering incomplete stories. Second, to add to that, collaterally, I think some special interest groups have discovered that they can almost partner with the media to get agendas across, and in somewhat of a sensational way by blaming police for shootings. Now, I'm not an apologist for police. I'm not making excuses for them, but a very small percentage of police do make mistakes of millions of law enforcement officers out there. And we're seeing that in some cases that these situations are being seized on to push agendas. So I don't know that that's fair to all policemen, and society's going to pay for that, I think. Jumping ahead just a little bit, it's going to be harder to recruit police officers to an environment that they feel is hostile.
Now, with this book, and you talk about the environment, and we all know, people listening to this program in America and outside of America know, they know of the situation in America right now, the racial tension and the tension between civilians and police. I don't know if it's ever been worse, but it's a very crucial period right now. So when you're talking about writing an entire book about a cop, you got to make sure that this is an extraordinary police officer and someone that's out of not typical, and that's what you found in Jim Simone. So let's go back to his upbringing and how and what things shaped Jim Simone so that he could. We talked about him going to Vietnam, so let's talk about his early childhood, his character, and what prompted him to be the kind of man that he became, a war hero in Vietnam. Let's talk about his early life.
Okay, well, I think Freud, you know, might have a field day with Jim. In talking to Jim, I decided to focus on Jim because Jim had been there, so to speak. He'd been involved in shootings. But what I really wanted to know is, why were you there? Why did you put yourself in those positions? I never really got that from him. Jim, you know, he's not completely an introspective person. He's a doer. He's a type A. He's a get-done person, not think about it. So I interviewed people around him, his brother, relatives, old friends, and he was raised by a very strong mother, very ethical, divorced at a young age, so he had a very close bond to his mother. His brother filled in a lot of the blanks. Mom was, you know, black and white. She didn't see gray. Either something was right or it was wrong, and she wouldn't tolerate wrong. I think she instilled those ethics in Jim. His relatives, his stepfather's father, were all military veterans, combat veterans. So from a young age, he had that filtered down to him, you know, the patriotism, willingness to serve, sacrifice your life for the country, those sort of ethics. And they were so strong that, he was the type of individual that didn't question them. So now we look back at Vietnam and, you know, maybe we really have some serious concerns about why we were there. Jim wasn't that personality. He felt it was his duty to go to Vietnam. Now, every step of Jim's way, not only did he want to join to be in the infantry, but he wanted to be a paratrooper. So there always seemed to be some sense of proving himself. And I kept asking Jim, you know, he wanted to be in combat. Jim, why did you pick situations or occupations that would put yourself at risk? And, you know, he never really knew. He could never really explain. And just guessing with what I know, I think, you know, he's always maybe trying to live up to somebody's vision of what he should be, whether that's his own or his mother's. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what drove him. But I think, I mean, he was a great soldier. I talked to his company commanders in Vietnam, and, you know, if they needed to go have somebody charge an enemy machine gun nest, hey, Simone, take somebody with you and get it done. And he'd do it. I don't know. I don't know why he put himself in those situations, but that's just what he did. He was, you know, obviously proving something to somebody. Okay. So, comes out of Vietnam, a young guy, and goes into police work. And, of course, he gravitates towards the most dangerous job a police has, which is traffic duty. Traffic stops in the middle of the night where, you know, the most dangerous people are, you know, are you interact with. So they're always, you know, throughout his life, there's always that that willingness, almost compulsion, to put himself in a situation where he could prove his gallantry, his courage. I would have to attribute it to something in his childhood if I, you know, as a layperson.
You write in a book that's an interesting scene where he's 18 years old and his stepfather walks into his room and says, hey, you know, you're 18 and there's a war going on, and basically tells him, go enlist tomorrow. So it's a testament to the kind of family he comes from that they expect this from their family members.
He really, in his mind, he didn't have a choice. He could have gone Navy, he could have gone Air Force, but, you know, Jim picked the 101st Airborne, a fighting unit. Guess, you know, see action. Go ahead.
You talk about his service in Vietnam, and it's impressive because of the bravery that he he shows towards his fellow military, and doing things like you call him a tunnel rat, where to go see if there was either bombs or army personnel in these tunnels. He was a small enough guy that he had gone in there at 160 pounds. You're saying he was down to 120 pounds. He was 5'7", and he could get into these tunnels. But tell us a little bit, just to describe the amount of the level of bravery, what these tunnels involved, and what involved Jim going into these tunnels.
During the Tet Offensive, I think that was 1968, the New Year, Viet Cong, Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese regular army made a series of devastating attacks on the U.S. and South Vietnamese bases, and they did it through that through a maze of tunnels that had been built in the Cu Chi district and really extended all the way throughout the country. And those had been built during the French Indochina War, where the Vietnamese were far outnumbered and outgunned, and they went underground. They had hospitals, they had ammunitions caches down there. They hid out, dining halls. So the order came down from the top that whenever you guys came across one of these tunnel openings, you couldn't just walk by it. You had to go in. You had to find out if there's anybody in there. So Jim, who had lost a lot of weight and is kind of a short guy, he's about 5'7". He's one of the few guys that could slip in there. And as I say in the book, they'd go in bare chested with just a .45 and a flashlight, maybe a knife in their teeth, crawl in head first, and look for Viet Cong, try to avoid booby traps. I mean, the booby traps were almost comically lethal. I mean, snakes and that would be tied to posts and poison bamboo sticks. But, your commander tells you to do something and you just do it. Technically he asked for volunteers, but, they're looking at you when they're asking for volunteers. So Jim, another way for Jim to distinguish himself, to show his mettle. He did it. He got the job done at his own risk.
Now, there's all these exploits that he has in Vietnam, which, again, shape him and make him the person that he is, and he's more than prepared to be a police officer when he gets back. But let's talk about just the incredible scene that you have here where, and again, it's important because, it's important in the story, this Lieutenant Bill Meacham and Simone is, again, risking his life out in the field and where he didn't have to, and he is shot in the throat. And so just take us to what his prognosis is in terms of people looking around on his likelihood of surviving, and this incredible story about this Lieutenant Bill Meacham that doesn't have to, he's a helicopter pilot, doesn't have to fly in there, but he does. Tell us about this story.
Right. Simone, he'd been trained as a radio operator. If I could just digress for really quickly, a radio operator in Vietnam just had to be quick thinker, he had to be sharp, he had to be organized, because you're communicating with so many different people, the base, the artillery guns, your commanding officer, your platoon, all at the same time. You got to keep everything straight. So Jim had that kind of mind that he could do that. And just digressing for a second here, I have some tapes of him on police chases, same organized, calm, under pressure mind. He's communicating with dispatch, with other officers, relaying his position, just very calm, like he's reading a newspaper. So even at 18 or 19 years old, some of the company commanders saw this and said, you're back here, you're a radio operator, you're not out in the field as much as we are. We want you out here with us. So they get him out, and first of all, corporals and sergeants were always the first ones in. They were very visible, even though they took their stripes off in battle. the enemy knew who was leading the charge because they were the first ones out of the foxholes, et cetera. So they were losing corporals and sergeants quite a bit. So on this one particular battle, they were out on patrol, a company, and they got nighttime. They were setting up an ambush. They thought they'd get a small group of Viet Cong coming, you know, passing through this trail intersection. And they look in the distance at night, and they see what looks like reeds waving in the wind. And it turns out to be a couple companies of Vietnamese soldiers coming back from attacking a fort. So they try to relay the message to the lead guy not to spring the ambush because, you know, there were like 50 of these guys and 200 of them, of the enemy. Well, they couldn't do it. He sprung the ambush. So that battle raged all night long. They got nearly surrounded on three sides. They were running low on ammunition. There was just no way to bring a helicopter in to replenish their ammo or even take out the wounded. The order came down to fix bayonets. A medic got killed. Another medic went to take his place. At that exact moment, RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade, exploded. That medic absorbed the shock, saving Jim's life, killing him and two other guys. Jim got some shrapnel in his throat. So he was laying there. He had a severe wound, bleeding to death, stuck his finger in his throat. Still manning the radio, though. He's still working the radio. His company commander came over, didn't think he was going to make it, but knew there was nothing he could do about it. So he went back to his position, made sure the guys were still firing, whoever had ammo left. Jim tells it, and this is in the book, Lest We Forget, by Bull Meacham, the helicopter pilot. Jim was just as he was passing out, he felt a guy lift him up and said, "Time to go, Sarge." Threw him in a helicopter, and carried him away. Now, that helicopter pilot, Bull Meacham, he was part of a group called the Kingsmen, they called themselves. He was a supply helicopter. He wasn't even a medevac. I mean, he just decided to drop down and help. Basically defying orders from the base because they felt it was too hot, too dangerous for him to land. So Jim was just very fortunate that, that an individual was willing, you know, I guess as brave as Jim, really, willing to take that risk to drop down and pluck him out. At 19 years old, and he had been promoted, I don't know if I mentioned this, he had been promoted to platoon sergeant, acting platoon sergeant at age 19 for a couple reasons, his leadership abilities and also the fact that they really needed personnel in those positions. So Jim had been in Vietnam for about 10 months at that point. He ended up recovering back in the States after that wound and decided that he'd had enough. It was his second Purple Heart, second Bronze Star. He just didn't want to go back. He'd seen enough death.
He had seen his friend die in his arms as well. Man named Ken, and he had seen a lot of death. And you say when he came back, he was not really prepared for the anti-war sentiment too. Somebody called him people spitting at veterans. But anyway, he came back and he was, again, you talk about how he was working as a phone operator, came back home, and then he was working at the home of a police officer couple. And they took a shining to him, and then they said, "Hey, I think maybe you would be a good police officer." And so, as you write in the book, very interesting, he shows up on their door maybe a year later in a Cleveland police uniform. And so Jim Simone is on his way.
Yeah, I just think he, in his words, he missed the adrenaline rush. He missed the camaraderie, the living on the tip of the knife edge. He wasn't getting that kind of satisfaction being a phone installer. He had that mentality, and this is him talking too. I'm not putting words in his mouth, but in Vietnam it was kill or be killed. They were the enemy. You know, kill them. I think in some cases, some of those veterans, they didn't get much counseling when they came back. You can't go through something traumatic like that as a teenager, see your friends die, killed, here 1 minute, gone the next, without that rewiring your brain somehow. And, of course, that's, as we talk about in the book, PTSD. That was never addressed. So Jim comes back. He becomes a police officer. Now, you know, there's a Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman who does a lot of lecturing, and he's fond of talking about the wolves, the sheep, and the sheepdogs, okay? The sheep being citizens, us, the wolves being, you know, the bad guys, the criminals, and, of course, the sheepdogs would be the police officer who protect us. That's kind of the facile way of police looking at their role in society is protecting us. Well, Jim had that. Jim very much adopted that ethos of him being the best person to protect us. And he brought that back to him from Vietnam, which is one of the reasons why he was a tunnel rat, why he was first in. He felt that he could do that function better than anybody else. So it should be him going first. He had a lot of confidence in himself. So it wasn't just hubris that caused Jim to be the first in. It was probably a mixture of self-confidence also. So Jim brings back that, like a lot of other Vietnam vets. Now, as I mentioned in the book, and I tried to be fair and objective in the book, I'm not just being a cheerleader for any one police officer. If you come back from war where everybody's not wearing your uniform is an enemy, and you maybe bring a little bit of that back here, especially in Cleveland in the early 70s. There was a lot of racial conflict. There was rioting. Police were not well-liked. The community became the enemy. Well, we know, of course, that the citizens, we are not the enemy. We have to be viewed differently than the Army viewed their enemy. So I think some of that was brought home with some of the returning veterans. And Jim just sunk his teeth into the business of being a police officer. He enjoyed it. I think he enjoyed the physicality of it. It was an opportunity to work off, maybe work out some issues. I don't know, but he definitely, back in those days, there was a lot of head busting, you know, a lot of fighting, a lot of brawling. I think it was just the way, at least in Cleveland, you know, in some cases, the way business was done, police business was done. And that's how Jim approached it. All or none, black or white, his way or no way. And I think that mindset contributed in a lot of ways to him being involved in situations where there was a confrontation with somebody. Back then, there really wasn't, there didn't seem to be an effort to really talk somebody down or negotiate or try to wait somebody out to see if they could get them to a different level mentally where you could disarm them. It was pretty much over in a flash. And Jim's first shooting was 1977, a couple years after getting on the force. Guy with a gun on a rooftop pointed it at him, and Jim fired. And that was his first shooting.
But you talk about the result right after that. You said that Reeser told Simone, "I will kill you if I have to." And he says, "If you do shoot me, my partner has his revolver aimed at your right ear." And then he said, "I'm not going to prison." And so Simone he pointed his pistol at Simone, and Simone fired his shotgun. And he said that other officers said that he went to the edge of the rooftop and vomited over the side. That's how upset he was that he had to resort to deadly force.
Right. No doubt that it, you know, it affected him emotionally. Reeser, maybe my primary objective in writing the book was to analyze those five shootings that Jim had been in, talk to the relatives, talk to survivors to see what what the dynamics were of that shooting. What were the steps that brought that person in conflict with the police officer? All of the five people that Jim shot had a very similar profile. They were all depressed, separated from their spouses. It indicated they were suicidal, had drug problems. Reeser was the same. He was a dishonorably discharged Marine, living in his car, had separated with from his wife. He had told his wife he wanted to die. I guess, you know, to use a cliche, suicide by cop. When he aimed his gun, he wrote his own script when he aimed his gun at a police officer. I mean, that was it. And, you know, Jim was the guy that fulfilled that wish, I guess.
You talk about it in the book, too. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dan.
What you write in the book, too, is to explain the situation at that time, and it is incredible. You said that in 1972 there was 333 homicides, where 10 years before there were 59. And the 70s ushered in a new era of, the drug era, basically. And he volunteered or was placed or wanted to be in a place where there had been riots, Glenville, and there was a noticeable tension between blacks and police. And it was incredible that, again, his bravery and his willingness to go into areas of conflict was very interesting, to say the least.
I would almost take it a step further. His need to go into these areas. He was, when that call went out for police down or police needed, I mean, his car was the first one there. I mean, he'd tell me that he had dash cam video of other officers driving away from the scene and as he was going towards it. It's just how he was wired to get involved. I think he got a taste of that excitement, that adrenaline in Vietnam. I mean, it must have been an incredible rush to be jumping a helicopter, be choppered into a landing zone, and seconds later you're trading gunfire with an enemy. I mean, you can't imagine the adrenaline involved there. And I suppose that gets addicting. So Jim enjoyed that. It was another way for him to show his bravery and distinguish himself from other policemen, make a name for himself. He couldn't avoid it. He wouldn't have missed that opportunity. Couldn't work nights on weekends. He'd be angry. He wanted Friday and Saturday nights. That's when all the action is. Couldn't sit at a desk. Jim could have never sat at a desk. Just wasn't his thing.
And even though he appreciated the promotion to homicide at one point in his career, he really just wanted to be a patrolman so he could be in on the action. And also just to describe him, because we haven't really described him, because it sounds like he's a little bit of a hot dog, but in reality, he's more of a, I know it sounds cliche, it sounds like something off television, but he's a guy that's trying to even though he's in conflict, there are numerous cases in this book where he disarms somebody, where other officers on the scene said that guy would have got shot. So he's, conflict resolution is what he's interested in, and also he just goes out of his way in so many different ways to help out. He really is unusual, and then the big thing that I thought was, again, very, very admirable and unusual, even for all the other police, is that his line that he drew in terms of his policing, he offered no one any breaks, and you offer great examples of that. So tell us a little bit about examples of how he never offered anybody a break, regardless of who they were.
Well, yeah, first of all, I wanted to address that about Jim's conflict resolution. Yeah, Jim would try to – Jim was a protector. Jim was a sheepdog, and – His objective wasn't, of course, to go out and hurt people or kill people. I found him to be too compassionate. too kind for that. That wasn't his goal. His goal was to disarm, disarm danger, to defuse situations. And if he could do it, he's a great talker. He's very quick on his feet. He's a very bright guy. And if he could talk somebody down, that's the way he'd do it. And he was very successful doing that. So, yeah, I should kind of make the point that Jim was involved in 5 shootings, but he was a very active police officer with 38 years of service. So that's, it seems like a lot, but he did his job. Yes, there were so many situations where he was able to handle a situation nonviolently. So I'm glad that I was able to get some of those in the book, and thank you for mentioning that. You, and I'm sorry, Dan, what was the I got myself lost here. What was the question that was on the table? You had,
well, basically what I was asking was examples of how he did. When we talk about an officer that shot 5 people and then we put in brackets, but those were justifiable, in the climate that is today, it would sound like maybe we're just pro-police because you see this sort of that blue code in play today, that no matter what is on that video, somebody says, well, you just don't know the circumstances. Not being very sensitive to the people that are out there that are seeing this videotaped seems to be, regardless of whether what's going to happen in a year at the trial, but it sure looks like an unjustified shooting. So when we talk about Jim Simone and the 5 homicides that he regrets having anything to do with, there are numerous cases of him risking his life to disarm somebody that would have been shot by police.
Not only did Jim see himself as a sheepdog protecting the sheep, let's just use that term for us, but he also was protecting other officers. Jim, because he had his military experience, he was a great shot. He was a pistol instructor. He had confidence in himself that he could resolve a situation, handle a situation probably better than anyone else. That was his leadership ability. That's part of his character, that leadership. That's why people gravitated around him. So he'd go in this situation, and I can't say that Jim went in recklessly. He went in because he knew he was the best guy for that job, because he had that military experience. He knew tactics. He knew strategies. He wasn't going in trying to shoot somebody. He just wanted to defuse the situation. Now, you had mentioned about his how equitable he was in treating people. I talked earlier about his mom, black and white, right or wrong. Jim has that same set of ethics. Very by the book. If it's wrong, it's wrong, no matter who's doing it. He was not averse to arresting his fellow officers, even his supervisor. He's a real stickler for drunk driving. He made a tremendous number of drunk driving arrests. And there were a couple occasions where he caught police officers behind the wheel when they shouldn't have been. And there are cases where Jim made the arrest. In fact, if other officers caught somebody behind the wheel, a well-known figure in Cleveland or another police officer, and they felt that this person should be arrested, they'd sometimes call Jim because they knew he'd do it. I mean, he wasn't afraid to put himself on the line and do that. And that's all part of his, I think I can attribute that to his upbringing, his mom, that code, that strict code that she instilled in him. I mean, it was hard for him not to do the right thing.
And this is a time when Cleveland police force, other police forces too, but Cleveland was notorious for officers taking bribes. So you, as you chronicle in the book, many cases where they said, no, that's okay, Jim, the case is, it's been handled or it's been dealt with or we're dropping it. And he said, no, we're not. So he really, he went against the brass. They called him Super Cop, but he went against the brass. But at the same time, even though, and you, I guess you can explain it, even though he did wood bust a fellow officer's kid for impaired driving or even a fellow officer, how did he maintain that line of respect within the police force?
Well, it became difficult for him. He had a dash cam before they were even equipped in cars. He had his own dash cam. Mothers Against Drunk Driving had given one as a prize, an award for making so many arrests. And then when Jim was arresting a couple officers and a couple friends of officers, he almost became a political liability to the brass. You know, Jim, you just give this guy a warning, drop this case. In homicide, he didn't want to take bribes, which is another reason he got out of that, so he could go to back to the street. So when the brass found out that Jim Simone wasn't going to play ball, and not that they were corrupt, I'm not saying they were corrupt, but in certain situations, they put a little lean on Jim a little bit, hey, give this guy a break, he's a friend of the force, things like that. Jim won. Well, once he did that, he became a pariah, a little bit of a liability, a threat. They couldn't control him. So he put himself in a position almost, and he would say this, where he almost had now to arrest another police officer if he was doing something wrong. Because if he cut that person a break, he wasn't following orders. He wasn't following the rules, and now he's breaking the rules, and they'd have a case against him. So Jim was in a situation now where he had to do everything right. His videos were a godsend to him. They backed up everything. Cases would get pleaded out in court once the defense attorney saw Jim's video. But, yeah, he started out with that code of ethics ended up being something that he had to adhere to because he made enemies among the brass. And not just because he was willing to you know, arrest fellow officers, but not that he went hunting for them, but he just didn't see color. Something was wrong, it was wrong. So not just that, but Jim was very active. Jim worked. He wasn't a slacker. His statistics for arrests, felony arrests, misdemeanors, traffic stops, drunk driving, they were all very high, much higher than in the other people in his district, in his unit. So, there was a little resentment and jealousy towards him from other police officers, of course, because he was outshining them. It's normal in any profession. So Jim ended up, as he would say, he wasn't real popular in the locker room at times, but he didn't care. He was doing his job. He had nobody to please but himself. He had set his own standards. He lived up to his standards. And he was pretty much a loner. He had a couple partners that he worked with very closely. But for most of his career, he rode alone. He was a one-man unit. He preferred that way. Then he could work at his own pace and his own style.
You say that it was your task to examine these shootings, and it's a good thing that you did. So let's talk about the David Workman shooting, where Jim Simone gets shot in the face, goes through his cheek and exits his body, even hits another officer. So tell us about the David Workman shooting and in November 1983.
Dennis Workman, again, fit that profile. Unhappy man in his 30s, relationship problems, job problems, drug problems, had expressed an interest in dying previous to this. He'd been up for about 3 nights. He was drug-induced insomnia. I interviewed his wife. His wife was very helpful, his wife and his pastor. Might have been hallucinating. He was paranoid. He hijacked a car to high school. And he holed up in a church. He told the high school principal, he ran into the high school and told the principal that he needed to save all the kids and let's take them down to the basement. The principal was quick thinking. She saw the gun in his waistband, by the way. And she said, hey, look, why don't you go to your church? Because he had told her where his church was. And I'll bring the kids there. He said, great, I'll meet you at the church. So they tracked the stolen car to the church, in front of the church. They knew he was there. They knew he was down in the basement. The altar was overturned. So Jim was working in juvenile division. He'd angered superior officer because he wouldn't drop a case against a highly connected attorney. So, you know, they dinged him a little bit and they put him in juvenile. Jim hears the chatter over the radio. Even though this wasn't his call, he was actually doing court in an hour. He charged over there because that's Jim's nature. You know, he sees danger. He knows he's the guy to take care of it. He gets to the church. He quickly sizes up the situation. They checked all the doors on the first floor, and Jim, you know, knew he's probably in the basement. So he starts heading down into the basement. Didn't ask anybody to go with him, but two other officers, John Thomas and Brian Miller, they couldn't let him go alone. So they followed him down there. Checked all the doors, except one door. There was a supply closet. So Jim had the guy stand behind him. He got down on one knee thinking if this guy shoots, he'll shoot over his head. Jim swung the door open. The muzzle of the Dennis Workman's gun, he rested it rested it against Jim's cheek. And wait a minute, sorry about that. I have a little phone problem. He placed the gun barrel against Jim's cheek and shot. It went in Jim's left cheek under his eye, out the back of his head, hit John Thomas's femoral artery, his leg, the officer behind him, and immediately blood started spurting from him. Workman then shot again, Brian Miller in his shooting hand. So he disarmed three police officers with two shots. Thomas, who was losing a lot of blood, crawled behind a wall. Miller fired back, but he was shooting with his non-dominant hand. Jim, when the bullet went through his head, Jim fell backwards. His head slammed against the linoleum floor, and he was semi-conscious. He was losing blood. Workman fired at Jim point blank and somehow missed him. And this is maybe a mystery of the book, because Workman was a former marksman in the Army. He was a hunter from West Virginia. He was a dead shot, according to his wife. And for him to miss Jim from 3 feet away is mysterious. But anyhow, he disappears back in the closet. Jim somehow summons up enough energy to get up on his knees and shot once, went through the closet door and killed Workman. He shot him in the chest. Then he passed out. They take him to the hospital, and even though he's shot in the head, somehow the bullet missed anything vital. They didn't even know there was an exit wound. He left the hospital 2 days later. Thomas was in the hospital for weeks because of his injury. Jim leaving the hospital 2 days later after getting shot in the head, that maybe began his nickname of Super Cop. You know, the legend of Super Cop began then. There was quite a bit of media coverage, of course, in a situation like this in 1983. And Jim became kind of a, you know, darling of the media. He was very quotable, always accessible. And the media liked him. The public liked him. And this was the beginning of Jim's Super Cop persona and his public recognition, this situation. Now, if we look at that case just quickly, I guess you can second guess it. You can second guess any situation. You know, maybe wait for SWAT, maybe wait for a supervisor. But in Jim's mind, I am 911. I am, you know, the white knight. I'm SWAT. I mean, there's danger in the basement. Jim's going to go down and confront it. That's what he was, you know, at some point, that's what he was hired to do. I mean, you can't fault them. We gave them the badge, the equipment, the training to go down and do that. There's a little second guessing on that, but in the end, you know, he took care of the situation. Dennis Workman had told his wife that he wanted to die. However, he had religious, he felt if he committed suicide, he wouldn't go to heaven. You know, if we were to surmise, maybe this was his way of leaving the world without, not by his hand. So Jim, he was off duty for several weeks, and he came back to duty.
Now, you talk, there's all kinds of stories that you chronicle in here about his bravery. And again, once he's attached his super cop sort of title, and also that he's the darling of the press, he goes on to save a person burning in a, that's in a, runs into a burning home. But let's talk just a little bit about a couple sad things and a couple good things in Jim's life, namely meets a woman. But to part of the reason why he runs into a burning house is that 5 years earlier, he gets a call and his 46-year-old mother. Tell us a little bit about that. Again, shaping Jim's character.
Yeah, Jim's mother, a very strong influence in his life. I had a very strong bond with her. You know, every night on his dinner hour, he'd go over there and she'd make him dinner. Tragic fire, electrical fire in her house. She died. I imagine Jim was devastated. A couple, not long after that, he's driving by a burning house with his partner. He knew he had been at he'd been on a case there. He knew there were children that lived in that particular house. He knew it would take a while before the fire department had got there, so he didn't hesitate. Maybe, you know, his mom's death in a fire motivated him, but he entered the house. He ran in. Again, just Jim's nature, hardwired to rescue the protector. Got in there, did the search, found that there weren't children in there, but did get overcome by smoke. A couple other officers went in after him and were able to drag him out. Jim, that particular incident resulted in Jim being named Police Officer of the Year for Cleveland. And, you know, again, we have the, you know, the super cop legend growing here. His willingness to risk his life to save others. Everything we, you know, that's what we want in a police officer, protector, fearless, doing the right thing. And Jim was doing that. You know, it's
story that later that day, though, while Simone was in the hospital, another officer comes and gives him a tip on a murder suspect.
Right.
Jim gets dressed, and they go make an arrest, and they find some machine guns and all kinds of weapons.
Right. These guys were machines. They were outliers. They just wanted to fight crime. They just wanted to it wasn't a job for him. Jim likes to say, if they knew how much fun I was having, they wouldn't have paid me.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too. You talk about a man that met him at that time, that the officer that got him to go arrest these guys with the shotguns and the machine guns. And this guy's a former Marine, and his name's Sumskis. And so they partner together, and it's a real good police partnership, isn't it?
Yes, it is. They both had a tremendous work ethic. Any hour of the day, they were policemen 24/7. It's just what they enjoyed doing. It was a passion for them. So Jim, you know, met his counterpart, and they were a great team. I think Dave was 50. He had Dave Sumskis. He had open heart surgery, and he didn't make it through surgery, but. Yeah, that was probably very tough for Jim. Here he meets a guy with the same values and ethics, and they had each other's back, and, you know, his partner died. They were quite a partner. They were so effective. They had pens. They were, 218A? I think they were. I probably have their car number wrong, but they were car 218A. They had pens made that you'll never get away from 218A. So throughout the neighborhood, throughout the district they patrolled, they were very popular, except with bad guys, of course.
Yeah. Now, you talk about a couple of the other shootings that he is unfortunate enough to be involved with. Why don't you discuss the next shooting that he's involved with and the particulars of that?
That would be the bank shooting?
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. That was Michael Chachi. Michael Chachi, young guy, had a drug problem, had injured his leg, couldn't work his construction job, had an argument at home with some family members, had to move out, depressed, just depressed, kind of angry at authority. I got this from some of his childhood friends. He had a gun. We don't know why he had the gun, but he was standing on the front lawn with the gun, and he had waved it at some police officers as he drove by them. That precipitated a chase, Jim in the lead. He stops his car in front of the house that he was staying at. There were maybe a dozen officers there. There is tape of this, and you can hear the officer screaming, "Put the gun down, put the gun down." And Chachi didn't put the gun down. Now, he wasn't aiming it at anybody, but he just didn't want to comply for whatever reason. They didn't want to let him go in the house because his friend, his wife, and their child was in there, and they were afraid they were going to have a hostage situation. So this is a difficult situation. You got a guy with a gun that wants to go in a house where there's a child. What do you do? So they're screaming at him, yelling at him. Jim tried to position himself so he could pepper spray Chachi, but at that point, Chachi turned and lowered the gun barrel, and he died. They fired at him. Jim was one of eight police officers that shot him. Turns out that the gun that Chachi was holding was unloaded. It was an empty gun. Well, they couldn't know that, of course. They didn't know that. I mean, just another situation of somebody that maybe just didn't want to live anymore. Another officer, during the gunfire, a bullet must have ricocheted and hit Jim in his vest. He thought he'd been struck by Chachi, but it was a friendly fire. So he went down. He went to the hospital. That shooting took a long time to sort out. The police prosecutor didn't rule on it for a while, so those eight officers were off duty. In Cleveland, they would spend time in the gym. They took them off the street and put them in the gym for a while, quite a long while, actually, until that got sorted out. And it did eventually, ruled justifiable, and Jim was back on the street. And do you want to talk about the fifth shooting now?
Sure. What I wanted to mention just before that is that in that shooting, you talk about sometimes maybe the media has an agenda or they have a narrative that they want to push or use a story as an example. What did they make of that case where wasn't it a black man who was shot and regardless of justifiable, the stories weren't so heroic or depicting Simone as such a hero in that case anyway?
Well, yes. What happened, well, though Chachi was white, though all of Jim's victims were white. Yes, what happened was, even though after the third shooting or so, it was just ruled justifiable, Jim was in defense of his life. However, you know, now you got a fourth shooting. Now, justifiable and not justifiable, people are starting to ask questions. Why one guy involved in so many shootings? What's going on here? Other officers go through their whole career without even drawing their gun. Why? So questions were asked. And then, of course, now we've got an additional fact that changes the story. The gun was unloaded. But that fact becomes part of the story, becomes part of the narrative, even though it wasn't a fact known to the police at the scene at the time. So we've got a little bit of the tide turning against Jim from a holistic standpoint that, yes, he shot four people. Those are four lives lost. Were they justifiable? Yes. Was he in fear of his life? Yes, of course. But, you know, it's getting to the point where the public was starting to say, what's going on here? The media in particular, a couple columnists, I think one of them actually called Jim a serial killer with a badge.
Right.
So he became a target. It became somewhat easy to brand him as somebody that's trigger happy. Never mind that there were eight other police officers there. And then now, whenever there was a police-involved shooting at this time period after this, the newscasters would manage to bring Simone's name into it. You know, they'd say, well, police officer, you know, they'd just bring him up randomly. They'd use him as an example of a police officer that was involved in a lot of shootings. So Jim's reputation was kind of preceding him a little bit, and that caused some problems for him. He became the go-to guy when people wanted to charge, you know, lodge a case of police brutality. They named Simone. In some cases, he wasn't even working the day they claimed that he beat him up. So, yeah, Jim became kind of a lightning rod at this point for charges that police were heavy-handed, were trigger-happy.
What did Jim feel like in terms of having that sort of spotlight on him and that sort of view of him as a police officer? What did, how did he feel about that?
I think he seemed to have regretted it. But he also, his mantra, and I think he's right, is that if you weren't there, you don't know what happened. I mean, we have, I have never had a gun barrel pointed at me. I don't know what I do. I'm sure I would be afraid. I'm sure I'd react maybe the same way he did. Unless you've been in a life or death situation, an actual situation where you feel like you're going to lose your life, it's very hard to judge the actions of somebody else. The Chachi case was difficult. He wouldn't comply. He wouldn't drop his gun. If he would have complied, he's still here today. There's no question. I talked to the neighbors that were there. You know, they pretty much confirmed the investigators' account of it, that the gun barrel was lowered. It was in a position to fire. What else could they have done? So on one hand, Jim regrets it. On the other hand, he's okay with it. He's okay that he did the right thing. And he did something that most cops probably would have done in that situation.
You talk about a split moment decision. But what I think a lot of people have issue, again, and maybe you spoke to Jim about this, this question that always comes up, was it necessary to have that many shots, to shoot that person that many times? What is his take on how many, sometimes how many bullets are used to kill somebody, which obviously more are spent than are needed?
Yeah, this gets in, this gets into a tricky area here. I talked to a police psychologist, a forensic psychologist who's an expert on stress and aggression, and he said the fear is contagious. Once one officer fires, the other ones are going to fire. We're talking about it right now. We're very relaxed. There's no danger. But in that rapidly evolving situation at nighttime with a guy with a deadly gun in his hand, anything could happen. They want to go home at night. So, you know, they're going to fire. They're going to defuse the situation, remove the danger, fire until it's over. Yes, it was a lot of shots. You know, there's some thinking there by the anti-police establishment, the special interest groups, that all police fire because then it makes it harder to determine who to make anybody culpable for a shooting. You know, they find all the bullets.
Right.
So who really fired first? You know, you hear those theories too. I just think it's fear is contagious. They don't want to be shot. So, you know, they took action.
Now you talk about we haven't talked about the final shooting that he is accused of or that he's involved in, the fatal shooting. So let's talk about that, the fifth shooting.
Okay. This guy, Robert Hackworth, he fit the template. Middle-aged or 30-year-old white male, depressed, drugs, lost his job, had a record. He had earlier in the day taken a test drive of a Jeep at a car dealership with a stolen driver's license, and he took off the Jeep. Drove down to a bank on a Jim's day off. Jim used to go in there on his day off to, he was, you know, he's the last guy to cash his paycheck at the teller window. He's in there. He knew immediately when Jim walked in the bank something was wrong because the tellers all knew him. They'd all wave at him and talk to him. This time they looked very upset. It was very quiet in there. He immediately figured out what was going on and who the robber was. The guy saw Jim. He ran out of the bank. Jim, not in uniform, but had his gun in his tucked in his belt. However, his radio was in his car. He gave chase. Now, the individual, Hackworth, had stuck his hand in his pocket to simulate having a gun in there when he robbed the teller. So he's running from the bank. A lady driving by, I wish I could have interviewed her. I never found her. But she might have recognized Jim. She said, that guy robbed the bank. Jim said, I know. She gave him a ride. They chased him. She stopped him right as Hackworth got into the Jeep, the stolen Jeep, to escape. The lady dropped Jim off right in front of the Jeep. So he was in Hackworth's line of fire right there. So Jim screamed, drop the gun, and, just hands up. Hackworth reached down towards his pocket. Jim shot one time, killed him. Turns out that Hackworth was unarmed. There was no gun. And what he was probably doing was the dye pack from the money that he had stole had exploded, and that dye pack contains tear gas. And it was burning his crotch, actually, and he was probably trying to remove that money from his crotch. This is painful. And that's the motion that Jim saw. Jim, the prosecutor in this case, decided to take this case to the grand jury. He felt that Jim was not justified in shooting Hackworth. So a couple things were going on. There were some demonstrations. Hackworth's girlfriend did some TV interviews saying that Jim acted rashly, had no business shooting him. He was unarmed. She died a couple weeks later of a heroin overdose, actually, and they had just had a child together, tragically. So Jim's going to go to the grand jury on this case, and there was a lot of media. The media really was starting to get on him about this case. Jim shot somebody over money. Well, it wasn't over money. He thought the guy was armed, and he was running around with a gun. If he was going to rob a bank, who knows what else he was going to do. Called 911, Jim. Jim likes to say, well, I am 911. This is my job. So yeah. He had his position. Others had theirs. The fact was, though, this was the fifth person he's killed. That's a very high number. Now, a reporter actually did some research throughout the United States and found out there was no other active duty police officer with that many fatal shootings that was still on the job. So Jim had, distinguished himself in a very infamous way with this shooting. So he decided that he wanted to talk before the grand jury. Kind of an unusual tactic to have the person talk before the grand jury because that can be used against him. But whatever he told that grand jury influenced them to return a no bill. He was not indicted. I think that shooting might have left him with a bit of a black eye. You can't escape the fact that the guy didn't have a gun, and then that fact became part of the story. After the fact, we now know he was unarmed. It colors the story unfairly, you would say, because he pretended he had a gun. So Jim, Jim's rocked a little by that. A year later, though, if I can move forward to the rescuing the women from the frozen river, Jim again distinguished himself. Two women intoxicated, walking through an area of Cleveland downtown by the river. It was frozen. They decided to walk over the river as a shortcut, and one woman fell in. Jim got to the scene. Rescue squads were there. He immediately starts stripping off his clothes. They're like, where are you going? He goes, I'm going in. And he went in after her. The water was so frigid that he managed to grab her. They saved her, but he went under. The fire department had to go in and save him. That action was his. He earned his second police officer the award for that for Cleveland. The only officer in the history of the city to earn that award. So, Jim was back in the spotlight. Super Cop was back. He was a hero, if you will, again. He had, I guess you could say, he'd redeemed himself from that Hackworth shooting, because that was controversial. Even though Jim, it was essentially ruled justifiable. Jim followed procedure. I guess you could say it did leave a bad taste in some people's mouths. But now, here, he saved a life at the risk of his own life.
You talk about that columnist or journalist that basically called him a serial killer with a badge, and then that person's reversal, too, going on a drive along with Jim Simone. So that, I thought, was very interesting. Maybe tell us a little bit about that conversion of attitude towards Jim Simone once she went on a ride with him during a shift.
I have to commend her for that. Actually, she's a very popular journalist and columnist in Cleveland, and she took a chance and started bashing Jim in her columns and questioning his tactics and essentially branding him a gunslinger and a guy that took unnecessary risks and was reckless. And Jim called her. And, you know, Jim, very cool-headed, professional, he called her and said, "Hey, you have the right to say what you want about me, but it would have been nice if you at least talked to me first." She took him up on that, on his courtesy call. She rode with him. And I think that a couple things happened. Jim's charisma. Jim's been, you know, incredibly charismatic. He's very straightforward and direct. You feel very comfortable around him. He is the guy you want next to you if there is danger. She probably gravitated towards his personality, number one. And secondly, actually saw on the streets at a late hour of night what happens and what could happen. She saw for herself that it's dangerous out there. And you don't have to go looking for danger in certain areas of certain cities. It's there. And if you want to do your job effectively and come between the bad guys and the good guys, there's going to be situations where you have to use your weapon. I think she saw that. And she ended up writing several complimentary columns about Jim. And it didn't help, of course, that the switchboard at the Plain Dealer, after her first couple negative columns, was deluged with supporters of Simone's who felt that she had branded him unfairly. So she even admitted that was a big part of her deciding to take the ride along, all the negative backlash she had gotten. She wasn't expecting that. I think she said in one of her columns she got 500 negative comments. So now, as a columnist, she's smart. Now she saw that Simone was she was going to get a lot of readership from writing about Simone. He was a controversial guy. He had a lot of supporters, and she kind of jumped on that bandwagon now. So, yeah, it was quite a conversion, actually.
Now, this police work took his toll in terms of his private life. He's divorced at 34, and he has three daughters. But you do tell about that he does have a good relationship with his daughters, and they have a good relationship with him. They have a good attitude towards him, as you write in the book.
Yeah. He's a dad. I mean, he took care of his daughters. He's a protector. He was not around a lot. He spent a lot of overtime. Jim's a workaholic. I mean, he would have been that way no matter, you know, what field he was in. It's just the way he approaches life, all or none. So he probably wasn't around as much as they would have liked. But, yes, I met all three, and they all have a very good relationship with Jim.
You do
talk to their father.
Tell us about the scene, the very profound scene that you have with the one daughter asking a question of her father and finally getting that answer after all those years. It's very profound.
Oh, God. Dan, can you refresh me just a little bit on that one?
Well, I guess it was the he had never spoken about Vietnam, so I guess mentioning.
Yeah, like a lot of combat veterans, he just didn't talk about it. And then, you know, one day, I mean, Jim's very, just in general, Jim gets very emotional about Vietnam. I mean, he's not a cold-hearted person as someone might think. He actually is very compassionate and very in touch with his feelings. And he is just losing a couple of his friends, that Kenny Kotaluk that you mentioned earlier, that medic that died, that had a profound effect on Jim. And I think, yeah, and he shared that. He opened up about that. He opened up about Vietnam. He got it out. And maybe for these poor guys that came back from Vietnam, maybe they could have had some counseling and been able to speak about things when they came back instead of years later. But, you know, it happened for Jim when it happened. Kotaluk dying, Jim saw at a young age how final death was, and, you know, that could have influenced his approach to danger. He didn't want to die. He didn't want other people to die, ironically. So he put himself in a situation to protect other people. Maybe, you know, that Kenny Kotaluk death impacted him so much. Other soldiers that I talked to that served with Jim said it really devastated him. So he finally got those feelings out when he was ready to get the feelings out. And it's probably a lot of burden for a veteran to carry around. Vietnam, we just didn't have, again, those social services available. Or maybe the veterans weren't really encouraged or incentivized to take advantage of those services. But, yeah, he opened up. And even now when you talk to him about Vietnam, he'll tear up. He'll tear up about it.
It's an interesting line you have in the book about, they said, when was the last time you were in Vietnam? And they said, everyone would say, last night.
Right. Still can't watch war movies. They still bother him.
Yeah. Now, when it comes time, finally, for Jim Simone to retire, tell us about the non-retirement, basically.
Yeah. Jim had to retire. He was at a certain age, and his the pension board had required him to retire, or he would have never left. He leaves. He waits out the 60 days that he has to by, you know, state pension law, and then he hooks up with a couple suburban police officers, and he's also doing warrants for the city. So Jim likes to say that retirement's been great. He's down to working 60 hours a week. He's still busy. He's still out there. He's still the sheepdog. It's just who he is. I don't think he could be anything else. It's what made him a good cop. It's what made him a great cop.
In the last part of your book, you talk about, you ask Jim Simone to talk about and deconstruct the shootings of Russell, Williams, and Tamir Rice. And these are the ones that have sparked so much controversy, so much unrest, and a complete rehaul of the way people think police and civilian relations have evolved over the years. It looks like we haven't evolved too far at all whatsoever, and the Black Lives Matter and the movement. So tell us what Jim Simone was, what he had to say when he was to deconstruct the shootings of Russell Williams and Tamir Rice.
Well, Jim's not a hypocrite. He's not a hypocrite. His mantra was, you don't know if you were there, and he wasn't there for either one of those shootings. However, he does have theories. So he couldn't speak, of course, to how the officers felt that shot, is what I meant. But the fear is contagious. Once you think somebody's shooting, and the police that were on the scene for the Russell and the Williams, the couple that was killed, they heard backfiring. They thought they were being shot at. There were a lot of mistakes made by the police officers that night. There were a lot of officers at that scene that shouldn't have been there at the scene. There were supervisors there that shouldn't have been there. Yeah, there were many strategic problems with that shooting. But Jim just said, you know, the adrenaline's flowing, your limbic system takes over. You're not necessarily thinking rationally. You just start shooting because other people are shooting. That's that case. Now, that was part of the Justice Department decree came down for that to overhaul Cleveland's Police Department. That was one of the situations that they looked at carefully and the Justice Department didn't like. So there's some changes being made in the Cleveland Department, Police Department, Division of Police because of that. That's one of the cases. All right, now, the Tamir Rice shooting, that's a little different because we have video. That was a 12-year-old boy playing with a replica gun in a gazebo at a park. He had removed the orange safety tip from the gun, though, so it looked like a real gun. There were a lot of mistakes made in that case, and Jim himself says in any shooting, there's a series of mistakes that lead up to the shooting. Somebody made some bad decisions and compounded those bad decisions that led to that, and this is a good case. Tamir Rice, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun. Somebody reported to the dispatcher that a guy was playing with a gun. Now, Tamir is large, big for his age. So this person said it could be a child, told the dispatcher that. That information was never relayed to the police officers who responded. They didn't know that. All they heard was somebody with a gun. So if you see the tape, and Jim analyzed the tape for a TV station, that car comes driving up towards the kid, Tamir rather, very quickly and skids on the snow. So those police officers now are right in front of Tamir Rice, whom they think is older and has a real gun. And from there, tragedy unfolded. The police officer shot Tamir a couple times. We find out he's 12 years old. We find out it's a replica gun. Of course, that's that's going to be something that the public is going to recoil against, and tragedy all the way around. Now, one of the things, though, that occurred was that the police officer, the tactics, maybe the car shouldn't have been so close, but Jim says that's procedure because most people run when you show, you know, when you the police show up, and Tamir didn't run. So we've got a lot of situations there that somebody might have done something differently in that situation. Jim didn't necessarily want to second guess that officer that was on the scene because, again, Jim wasn't there. But that information, the dispatcher then that didn't relay that crucial information that it might have been a child, just quit her job. She wasn't really available to debrief. So that was a tough case. That was a very difficult case.
And in the now, legacy that is...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The legacy of Jim Simone is not only that he's a patrolman of the year in 1980 and 2009, but also that he was, again, a sort of a pioneer in terms of putting things ahead that put forward things like dash cams and the importance of dash cams. And so other than the dash cam importance, and we obviously can see why that's important to protect police, protect citizens, it's just a great thing. But also, what are the other things that Jim Simone basically was a big advocate for in terms of helping the police have relationships, positive relationships with citizens, and just to be able to do proper policing? What were the kinds of things that were most important to him, things that he had done, things that he recommended and advocated for?
One of the things Jim was very big on is being not only policing a community, but being a part of the community you police. He lived in the district that he policed. He was always visible, always accessible. People knew they could contact him at home. He was okay with that. He encouraged that. I mean, nowadays, Cleveland doesn't have a residency requirement, and a lot of policemen live outside the city, and as Jim puts it, you know, they come into the district for work every day like an occupying army. They're not vested in that community. They don't. It's a job for them in a lot of cases. So community policing, part of the community, be visible, talk to the people. Don't just ride around in your four-wheeled capsule and make arrests, but actually walk around, patronize, be on, you know, be on the streets. People like that. Now, we talked earlier, very early in the conversation, we talked about the anti-police bias. Well, I have to be a little bit of a contrarian here. I don't think that's necessarily true. In the worst areas of the city, the most crime-ridden areas of the city, those people depend on the police. Those people like the police because that crime is right there. They see it, the break-ins, the drugs, the danger. They know the police are the only thing protecting them from danger. So they appreciate the police. I don't think there's anti-police bias in a lot of situations in the inner city. I mean, I talk to people who appreciate the police. So I think that some of these anti-police bias that we're seeing is perpetuated by special interest groups, groups that are pushing an agenda, good or bad. I'm not judging their agenda, but they've found that they can get their message in the media very effectively. But I don't think that anti-police sentiment is as widespread as we might think. I don't. And I quote, well, yeah, I'll leave it at that. I think that the people that we might think are most against the police really appreciate the police.
It was interesting to point out what you're saying is that Al Sharpton was ready to pillar Jim Simone, but when he found out that the victim was white, he abandoned it, which is very interesting.
Yeah, the Hackworth shooting, he requested Jim's personnel file. Found out that Hackworth was Caucasian and dropped the request.
That's amazing. Just before I let you go, Robert, what is the story of Jim Simone today? What's Jim Simone doing today? Tell us about that.
Jim, still patrolling. He's working for a couple suburban Cleveland police departments. He's working midnights, 67 years old. He still does a midnight shift. Then he's serving warrants for a Cleveland agency. He's still working. He's still out there hustling. Still being the sheepdog.
Yeah, amazing. I want to thank you for coming on and talking about Badge 387. It really is a story of America's most decorated cop. This is one colorful, actually very humorous kind of guy as well, but just what an indomitable spirit this man has and a real good cop, basically giving cops a good name everywhere. This is one of those stories in the face of police being criticized everywhere and all being lumped into the same mold as the bad cop will say, or the cop that's irresponsible. This is an incredible story of a very, very decorated cop and very, very deserving of that. So I want to thank you very much and coming on and talking about Jim Simone, America's most decorated cop. Thank you very much, Robert, for this.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. Thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.